Here at Guitar Nerds, we want to make sure you have the best chance to listen to all the guitar content that's right for you. That's why we have a Patreon. Patreon.com/guitar nerds. A veritable treasure trove full of interviews, mini-series, and a whole extra half an hour episode every week. Patreon.com/guitar nerds. Get your nerd on. And welcome to the Guitar Nerds Podcast, the world's number one guitar podcast. I am your host, Joe Branton, joined this week by Jay Cross.
Who is Jake Ross? And why have you brought him into the equation?
I did just once. I want like a smooth, you know, sort of professional introduction to a podcast for like new listeners who are like, what's this podcast, who's on it? Oh, I now know both of those things within the first 15 seconds.
You should have thought about that before you invited me to come on this podcast 5 years ago. That's all I can say. And when I say you, I mean
I had nothing to do with it. No. I was the comic relief at the time and I was terrible at
and
that.
Still are.
So we were supposed to be podcasting as a three tonight. Matt Knight is off. Oh my goodness, there are so many things happening at Boss HQ that Matt Knight has had to take a couple of weeks to sort some shizzle out.
I don't know where he's. He's on. Is he on tour? I feel like he's like just away. Yeah,
he's doing something like that, isn't he? Because they've got some new people, and I think they're going around like talking to, they're visiting retailers and whatnot with all their new team, and Matt Knight's heading that up or whatever. He's doing some grand tour of places that sell their gear, I guess. But that was going to be fine because we also have Mark Packham. You know, and if we don't have Mark Packham, we've got Mikey Demas, or we've got Mary Spender, or we've got Dan Grace. But Mark Packham was like, yep, absolutely, I'll be there. And he didn't consider the fact that being there for a podcast also involves having some form of internet connection. Hence why it is the two of us. But that's okay, because actually we've got with NAMM around the corner, there are a ton of new releases. And what's extra good about having you here solo, J Cross, is that a lot of those things are Fender. Fender have put out an awful lot of new releases. But before we go into things like the news, how's it going, J Cross? You've been going to a lot of gigs this week.
Yeah, I'm good. I did go to three gigs this week, which I suppose is quite a lot considering that's almost 50% of the week. But yeah, no, it's been good. I had a really good week actually. I took a couple of days off because I've still got loads of holiday left, and I wanted to spend Thanksgiving with Maddie, my girlfriend, who is American and living over here. So obviously in the UK, Thanksgiving isn't something that we celebrate in any way.
I saw an excellent tweet pointing out that if we were to celebrate a Thanksgiving for a time that we came to a country and misplaced the native population, we would never go to work.
It's a very good point. So there's no Thanksgiving celebration in the UK, but I wanted to make Maddie feel at home, so we both booked a couple of days off, and it coincided with one of our friends bands being over on tour. Someone who Maddie used to live with, our friend Pat, plays drums in this band Joyce Manor, who are a great pop punk band from California. He's from Philadelphia, but they're from California. They're on Epitaph, which is like
a fantastic
childhood dream from for people like us. They're on tour with Basement from the UK. And it was great. We went to see him in Southampton, and that was really fun at a venue, 1865, which is somewhere they've never been before. And on Thursday night, we went up to the London show, which was at the Forum in Kentish Town, which is a cool venue. I've been there a few times. It's like sloped down, which is really good for us because Maddie is 5'2 and I'm 6'2. So finding somewhere where we can stand and she can see and I'm not blocking people is really difficult most of the time. but luckily we were able to find somewhere. And yeah, Joyce Manor were amazing. Like, I've seen them a few times. They're such a good band. It was really good. But the thing that I found really funny about the whole thing was, so they were playing in front of, it's a 2,300 cap venue, I think, the Forum. So like, you know, two and a half, somewhere like that. And the guitar players were using, one guitar player was using a Hot Rod DeVille. So, you know, that's fine, 60 watts, four speakers. The other guitar player was playing an AC-15 in front of 2,500 people. And it sounded absolutely fantastic. So a question came up in the group this week.
Yeah, I was going to say there was something in the thread on the Facebook group.
So a question came up in the group this week about, you know, whether 15 watts was big enough to, was loud enough to gig with. And I cited that example. And a couple of other people were like, oh yeah, I was at that show as well. And I thought exactly the same thing. So that was really funny. Really nice to know that. You know, we're all guitar nerds 100% of the time, even when watching, I suppose that makes sense when we're watching bands, but it's, and of course that's a bit of a frivolous comment because these things are all relative. It's easy to be able to say, oh yeah, I can use a 15 watt amp when you've got a incredible PA system, behind you, making sure that everything is mic'd up and sounding crystal clear. So
if you're not relying on the stage itself providing any sound for the audience, then yes, it's great.
Exactly. So it was, I thought that was very funny that it was, it sounded so good and they were really only using small amps. And I spoke to them about it afterwards and they said that they used to use, the Barry, the singer, was saying that they used to use like big Marshall 100 watt amps and 4x12s. And it always sounded bad because they, on stages that size or, you know, not even that size, you can't ever get the amp loud enough because it is going through the PA and it never ends up sounding good. So they've just dropped down to lower wattage amps and everything just sounds fantastic. So, you know, I think when you are a band playing anywhere sort of sizable, anywhere where you've got a PA, a 15 watt amp is always going to be fine. I realize that me saying that to you is difficult when, you know, your band tour with 200 watt Katanas and a 300 watt Ashdown amp. But you know, I do think it's, I do think that these things are always, it was just very funny.
Yeah, no, well, I think you're totally right. I've got, buckets of time for sort of low wattage amps. I would always rather, I mean, the 100 watt Katanas are, of course, like a, you know, it's a digital 100
watt. Yeah, solid state, aren't they? Yeah.
But yeah, but you know, if I kind of find 30 watts is always like the optimum. 50 watts is fantastic. But the, you know, it stays clean at such relatively low volume. Fantastic if you don't need any clean, then they sound amazing. But 30 watts is kind of optimum to give you the best of both worlds. And any more than that, I've always found just a touch surplus. But you know.
Yeah, I mean, again, I think it really depends on what you're doing. I think for bands like a band that I were playing, where you're more than likely to be small stage, plugged in, mic'd up, 15 watts is going to be fine. Even playing in, if I was playing the level sort of, you know, a venue that wasn't quite as nice, if it was just a back room of a pub, probably then even still 15 watts is going to be all right. But you're more reliant on a clean sound as the bass, you know, to get the modulation effects through. Whereas if you're playing in a punk band, you kind of want it to be a bit drivey. So having it turned all the way up isn't going to be a problem. So I think whenever you're looking at buying a new amp, it is just a case of working out, okay, well, realistically, where am I going to be playing this? Am I going to be playing it at home? If I'm playing it at home, can I turn it up loud? If I'm playing it at home, do I want to be turning it up loud? And if that's the case, then look at a lower wattage amp. But at the same time, if what inspires you to pick up the guitar is to have a 4x12 and 100 watt amp with loads of air moving behind you, and your neighbors aren't going to threaten you with council served noise abatement notices, then go ahead and buy that 100 watt amp and 4x12, because at the end of the day, it's all about making sure that you are playing what inspires you to pick up the guitar every day.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. And you know, speaking of amplifiers and gigs, I was also at a show. There were a number of shows, but one of the shows I was at earlier this week was a very small show at the Quadrant, Jay, believe it or not.
Oh, yeah. Yep.
But I went to see a few bands there, and the opening band, the guitarist had a Kemper profiler.
Really? At the the Quadrant? Amazing.
Yes, absolutely. It was totally out of sync with every other piece of equipment that was there that night. But he brought his Kemper, and he had nothing on the floor other than the TU3. And I realised, because I was there to help out, actually. I had a friend promoting the show, so I was there to do the door. But I watched them sound check and realised that what they were actually doing is running a backing track. So the drummer was on in-ears with a laptop, and he was running a backing track that was also synced with the Kemper, and that was doing all the pedal switches.
Oh, right, wow, okay.
As well.
So what, was that like an Ableton thing?
I couldn't see the laptop, so I would assume so. Yeah, yeah. Something like that. But it's running all the effects switches for the guitarist as well. And there were quite a few. There were quite a sort of a proggy, dreamy band. So there's a lot of modulation going to sort of big, like, squealing solos into like really clean parts, and the guitarist was switching between a pair of different Stratocasters as well. So it was there was a lot going on. The problem that he had, and this for me really sealed what I think of Kempers and why I'm not wholly convinced at them being a solution to a problem that necessarily exists, is, and this will come around to it, because I'll explain what the band on after had in a minute. The problem that this band had was that he messed up at one point, and then he was out of sync with the click track, which meant all his effects were changing in a different place as well.
And so
he had no choice but to literally stop the song, because he couldn't find it again. He couldn't get back in, so he had to stop the song, for which he apologized and explained, and then they started the song again. And then later in the set, obviously they even, because the whole thing had like atmospheric sounds in between, but of course all his effects changes are still, you know, a part of this master track. He realized that he didn't have his capo with him. It was in his guitar case.
Oh no.
So he had to go and get it. It was before a song had started, but it's in an atmospheric bit. But of course he knew he wasn't going to have time to get to his guitar case before the song started, so he had to just ask the drummer to pause the track. And I was just like, oh, at this point you've stopped a song and had to start it again, and you've had to ask a guy to pause a track, and this is all for a £2,500 solution to you having to step on a few pedals. Like, it just, for me, I was really like, oh. I mean, I thought they were excellent, by the way. I thought they were really good. This is certainly not, nothing negative on the band. I thought they were very good. And it was definitely early doors for him using that Kemper. But I was just like, this is not a solution. I've never seen this before. I've never seen this sort of mess up that just wouldn't have occurred if it have had a pedal board and an ordinary amp head. And the thing was, and yes, it was. Listener, the venue we're talking about was a very small pub in Brighton with a really small sort of upstairs.
I think it's a cap of like 40 people, I think.
Oh yeah, yeah. It's literally tiny. So it has a stage area which you can fit the drum kit on, and that's it. It has a very, very basic PA. But the thing was, the Kemper also, in that environment, didn't excel. It didn't sound good.
No, like, well, that I think was I th- the what. So they weren't. Like, they didn't have a. They didn't have like a cab, spider. Right?
Yeah, he was
no
cab.
So it was
cab.
All coming through.
No,
the
no, it was. It was a cab. He was running it through like a 412 Marshall, one of those ordinary ones, the angle top ones.
Right, okay. 960A, probably.
Yeah, yeah. So it was all going through that, but it just didn't sound good. It sounded like a spider. Like the modulation sounded cheap. Like it, you know, maybe it would have done better on a, you know, in a different environment, but it's, or maybe it was just the way he'd set it up, but it didn't sound great. It didn't sound like $2,500.
I mean, that
and
sounds,
then there were the mess ups.
It sounds to me like maybe they hadn't turned on, or they had left on cab sim, maybe.
Potentially, you know, yeah.
Because that's something that you do hear about quite a lot. And if you've got cab sim on and then you're going through a cab, is that right? That sounds right.
Potentially, to me. I mean, in sound check, he was complaining that this didn't sound like how it normally sounded and stuff. But nonetheless, there was a lot of faffing and then a lot of messing up in the set. And on top of the fact that it really didn't sound that good, all those things together.
Yeah.
Band afterwards got on, and the guitarist, and I was watching them play. I didn't catch their sound check, so I'm just watching their live set, and I was like, this is fantastic. This guitar sounds absolutely brilliant. And it was a road-worn Tele, where he'd changed the bridge to like a normal hardtail bridge and shoved a humbucker in there and was just running off of that. And it looked amazing because it was so beat up and it sounded fantastic. A handful of sort of, you know, tasteful pedals, you know, whatever, a Hall of Fame. There was a big muff down there. I think a crayon, the electro-harmonics crayon to drive. I was like,
Oh, okay, yeah.
Just a few sort of choice things, but everything sounded great. And I was like, looked over to see what the amp head was, and I could see that Marshall 412, and I couldn't see anything on it. And I was like, well, what's going on? So I looked back at the board to see if I could see something like, I don't know, a 44 Magnum or something like that. You know, so I'm looking around there, couldn't see anything. So I went and spoke to the fella afterwards. And he was running one of those Vox MV50s, the new tubes.
Oh, right. Okay.
Yeah. So it was just sat behind the cab, so on the floor to keep it out of the way. But yeah, the new tube is like a tube state, so kind of like a tube preamp sort of thing. But it's supposed to be something completely different that sounds way more tubey, but is, you know, as reliable as something not tubey. So Vox do a number of them. I don't know if we've ever really spoken about them on the podcast. But they do like a number. There's like a boutique, an AC, a British, a metal. You know, they do loads of different types. They're 150 quid.
Yeah, that's pretty well priced, isn't it?
And blind testing, sort of without seeing the amp head. Now, I'm not sure which one he had. I think he said he had the AC when I asked him, because he said he used to use an AC30, but he'd moved away to Canada and come back, and he hadn't bought a new amp yet, and this was the cheapest, closest thing he could get to it.
AC sounding, yeah.
But it was £150, and blind testing, because I couldn't see the amp, I was like, damn, this sounds good. And this was directly after seeing someone go through a two and a half thousand pound head, and me being like, this doesn't sound good. And obviously sort of, you know, in fairness to the fella with Kemper, I think it was early doors for him using it.
Yeah. And I mean, you know, in fairness, they're just not really designed to be used in that space, are they? You know, that they've been designed to be used by big bands playing in big venues with high quality PAs, or they're designed, and I think they're used a lot by people in who play in churches, again with large PAs, and it's just high quality stuff. That's always kind of been my concern with the Kemper stuff, is, and also to a certain degree with the Helix and stuff, is you have to rely on the quality of the PA. And if you're playing in being someone who has been to, you know, 1,000 gigs in dingy pubs around the southeast of the UK for the last 20 years or so, 15 years or so, you just can't ever be that reliant on it. So I don't know. I'm sure there's people just yelling and shouting at their iPhones here now, just saying like, just shut up, you don't know what you're talking about. And they could very well be correct. But that's always just been my opinion on it. So
yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
I tell you, another thing that I thought was quite interesting, another gig that I went to this week I went to see this band Rehasher, which is the side project of Roger Lima, I think his name is, the bass player from Less Than Jake. The bass player and vocalist from Less Than Jake played in this band Rehasher that are they started 15 years ago. I think I bought the first record in like 2003 or 2004, and it's just kind of like NoFX style skate punk. He was really interestingly, he was playing what I think was a LTD EC1000 with an Evertune, which is just something that you just very rarely see like punk bands using, is first of all like LTD guitars, and secondly the fact that he had an Evertune on there. It was just, you know, like this kind of new innovation is something that the punks usually stay away from.
And plus I would have thought the whole sort of concept of the close enough for rock and roll thing was kind of right up punk, you know, punk rock street. Like, you kind of want to be a little bit out of tune. The Evertune's never going to let you do that.
Yeah. it sounded great. It was just that going into a, what was it going into? I think just an orange of some sort. It sounded good. Sounded cool. It was just quite a surprise. You just rarely see. Oh, actually, and that's another thing of things that you rarely see. And sorry to jump back to Joyce Manor here, the topic I was talking about earlier. The one of the guitar players from Joyce Manor was using one of the new Made in Japan Blue Flower Strats. Which I thought was something that you very rarely see like out in the wild. You know, you don't often see a Pink Paisley or a Blue Flower guitar being used live. And let me tell you, when they played in Southampton, the venue was like relatively low ceiling, and in comparison to what the Forum was like. And when those bright lights were shining down on that Blue Flower guitar, when he was moving around, it looked unbelievable. Just like these sparkles just glinting out across the venue. Oh man, it looked so good. So, so good. So I cannot recommend that kind of like sparkle. If you're playing live in a venue like that, just that guitar it looked unbelievable.
There's Pink Paisley Jazz Masters at the moment.
And Blue Flower as well. So they were a run that came out at the same time. They just look fantastic. Really, really cool.
Yeah. I need to see those more. They need to be more. The Pink Paisley and Blue Flower stuff is always limited edition whenever Fender do it. I wish they would just keep it as part of the range. Do you remember when they had the P bass in the like the 54 version of the P bass, so still with the straight the non-staggered version of the pickup?
No, I don't remember that. No.
Yeah, they did it as a Japanese model maybe a decade ago, and it's fantastic.
Okay. And again, was that in what, Blue Flower and Pink Paisley?
Yeah. Yeah, and again, out of Japan, and it's just one of those things that turned up for a little bit and then disappeared, and we've never seen it since.
Right. Okay.
What a wicked finish. I wish they would make that more of a thing. On that note, we should dive headfirst into some news, because there's quite a bit from Fender.
News.
So first up, Jay Cross on the news. Oh, I can't remember what we were going to talk about first.
Well, there's loads of stuff that's come out this week, and a lot of it is kind of limited edition stuff, I guess. I think there's just a few bits and pieces knocking about before NAMM comes out, and before, you know, all the whatever happens at NAMM. But there's a couple of bits that I really wanted to talk about that I thought were really very exciting. Is just announced, and maybe today as this podcast goes out, is a brand new, let me just bring out the details again, brand new lightweight deluxe reverb. So
wait.
Yeah, so it is...
When has that ever been something Fender have cared about?
Completely, completely. And I think it's something that's really, really interesting. So it's the way that the weight has been shifted is in a couple of ways. So first of all, it's being that the chassis is like a lightweight pine as opposed to, you know, the sort of... everyday harder wearing, not harder wearing, because I don't think this is going to be I don't think it's going to be you know, any less durable, but it's just a lighter bodied amplifier with more expensive lightweight wood. And also it's got neodymium speaker in it, which again is super lightweight. So I can't remember the exact numbers, but I think it's like a quarter lighter than they normally are, like 75% of the weight of a standard one. I can't remember the exact numbers, but it looks amazing. The
cutting to what's important about the Deluxe Reverb, what finish is it in?
It's a 68. It's a 68. Right, okay. So it's an FSR based around the 68. So it's the silver face with the blue jewel light and the blue writing and the blue fret and the silver fret cloth. So, you know, no one would ever know that it was light. No one would ever know that you're a pansy that can't.
Come on, this was the perfect time for them to release it in like an interesting Tolex, like fawn.
Well, I mean, you say that, but at the same time, any if that was to be the case, people would just say, why are you doing all this stuff? Why can't you just make a normal one lighter? You know, that's absolutely what would happen. So yeah, that's really cool, and they're super limited. There's only a handful coming to
I'm
Europe.
I'm excited by that. Do you remember when Squire released a Pine Telecaster?
Squire released a Pine Telecaster.
I think it was Squire. It wasn't Fender. It was Squire. Yeah, do you remember?
No, I mean, yeah, Pine is a body that gets used every now and again. Obviously, it's a bit of a premium finish because it's just an unusual wood to make a guitar out of. But I don't remember there being a Pine.
Yes. Squire. Yeah, that's right. It was. I believe it was. The
Classic Vibe. The Classic Vibe 50s, the blonde one is Pine. Yeah, apparently. I didn't know that.
The one that was available. Yeah, yeah, that was the one I was thinking.
Just like the iconic 50s Classic Vibe telly. I have sold probably, I don't know, 100 of those in my when I was working at CAC. Wow,
they did those in two finishes, didn't they? Because they did the normal butterscotch, and then I think they did a white blonde version of it as well.
Yeah,
as
vintage blonde, which I have. Also pine. Right, wow, interesting. Mm,
exactly. And that was the only reason I mentioned that is I don't remember them being especially light, and I think those would be the only guitars that I would know that were made out of pine. So I wasn't aware that pine was considered a
Joe, this is special lightweight pine, so back off.
Of course. Okay. Weight relieved pine.
That's it, yeah. Weight relieved, yes, chambered. So it you know, get a load of resonance from it because it's not chambered. Please don't quote me on that. It's absolutely not chambered. But so the other thing that's kind of a limited run that again I think is a really cool spec is there are some limited edition American ash strats. So ash body with a roasted maple neck, which is, you know, something that we've seen from lots of companies recently, and is just a really lovely neck, and Fat 50s pickups, which are some of my favorite Fender pickups.
This is a bit of a bandwagon for Fender to be jumping on, the roasted wood. It's very topical at the moment.
I'm not sure that's strictly true because, granted, this is, you know, not Fender, but the Charvel Guthrie Govan has been out for a long time, and that's that was
so beyond. It's like, you know, if you know ice cream's good, but if you eat a truckload of ice cream, it's not good. That's what I think about the Govan.
That's a real specific analogy. Did something happen to you this week on tour? Did you Do you bump into a dairy-free ice, Mr. Whippy, and just get too excited? Is that what it was?
Jay, no, I tell you what, though, I will tell you this. I mean, we're going slightly, I'll keep this short because we'll be going slightly off of the thing. But I was in Ramsgate last night. In fact, dear listener, I got back from Ramsgate at 3 o'clock this morning. I had to be in work at 8, which was tons of fun. But, and I'll now be editing this podcast until about 1:30 this morning, which is even better. But anyway, I was in Ramsgate playing a gig last night, and yeah, Ramsgate, like it's like the slightly worse version of Margate. But the venue was absolutely lovely. It turned out the venue had won like a best small venue for the last couple of years in the NME. But anyway, lovely venue. But we went out for dinner, and I was thinking, well, I'm not going to be able to find anything vegan in Ramsgate, surely. And we found a fish and chip shop, and I was like, but that's fine, I can probably get chips here. We went in, oh my goodness, they had a whole wall of vegan menus. I was able to toe fish and chips.
Oh really? Wow, how about that?
Oh yeah, it was great. And is they that, did a toe fish burger.
Shaky Shaky Fish Bar, is that what that is?
It is Shaky Shaky Fish Bar, it's that one.
I've just googled Ramsgate vegan, and that's what comes up. So that's that fantastic. Amazing. Good work.
Honestly, it was some of the best toe fish and chips I have ever had.
But have you had toe fish and chips before? Or is that
No, I hadn't, actually.
Okay. So there we go.
It was very good. It was very good. But anyway, the point was, don't eat a truck full of ice cream. And yeah, in the same sense, Guthrie Govan, if you like baked maple, just don't make everything, even the pickups, baked maple, because it just looks stupid. It was a stupid looking guitar, but
it sounded amazing though.
They sounded great, and they were fantastic. Very popular despite the £3,000 price tag.
So back to my point. I don't necessarily think that it's a bandwagon per se. I think it's just
It's not. I don't mean that they're copying. I just mean it's very popular at the moment.
It is, yeah, it is, and it's when you've got
that Fender are doing lots of pastel coloured guitars at the moment because pastel colours are in. I think it's interesting that they're doing roasted maple.
Who do you think? What are you talking about? Fender have been doing pastel coloured guitars since the 1950s when Leo Fender went to a car garage because his mate worked there to get some paint because he thought that was the cheapest place to get paint.
That is true, but what I mean, accessible pastel colours. When you and me started working in guitar shops, you could get an affordable Fender in candy apple red, black sunburst, or a rubbish blue, and or Olympic white. And now everything's available in Seafoam and Daphne, and you know a million other.
And so what you're saying is, back in the day when people like, you know, for example, me had no say in the sort of guitars that. get made and
you heard
and,
it here first, and make, listener. J Cross claims to
and make their way over to Europe. And now you know someone someone like me. I'm not necessarily saying me, but someone like me is you know in a position of relative authority where decisions like this can get made. All of a sudden, there are loads of pastel coloured guitars and guitars with
yes.
baked maple necks and all. But you're right, a mystery, true mystery.
But baked maple is super hip at the moment, and it's really it looks fantastic, and
yeah,
it's starting
it
to
does.
Occur on tons of guitars all over the place. So really nice that we're finally getting it on some Fenders that aren't custom shop.
Totally, and so I would definitely recommend checking these out. They come in three-tone sunburst and really fetching ocean turquoise, both with black plates and black you know, like trim cover and knobs and stuff like that. So they look really cool. They look sharp. Yeah, they do look really cool.
I love ocean turquoise. Do you remember that classic player bass that came in ocean turquoise? It was the first time I'd seen ocean turquoise as a color.
No, I don't.
It was like a short scale matching headstock, three pickup Jazz master shape.
Yeah, the Rascal. That's what you're talking
the
about.
The Rascal.
Isn't it?
Yeah.
I never
bought one. I really regret it. In fact, someone I know sold one recently, and I didn't buy that either. And I don't know exactly what I was thinking.
There is one on, and I hate to shill. I know. I'm sorry. There's one on Reverb at the moment for £563. So, that 30-inch scale. I forgot about this. This was a really cool bass. Really weird.
Well, it was probably the only classic player bass to come out. Because I don't know if there are any other classic players. Jay, explain for the listener, if they don't understand the difference between classic series and classic player series from Fender.
So the classic series are guitars that are just... very traditional. So you get the classic 50s. I guess a very easy way to look at it is the difference between a classic 50s Tele and a classic player Baja 50s Tele, because that's kind of the example that we would talk about a lot here. So just a classic 50s Tele is block. It's just a slab body with two vintage voiced pickups and a three-way selector switch and probably a chunky
neck. So it's affordably and loosely trying to pay homage to the era of which it's portrayed.
Absolutely. And then the classic player, and again, take the Baja, for example, takes the look and the vibe of a classic series guitar, but adds a couple of modern features. So in the Baja, for example, you've got the four-way selector, you've got the S1 switch, and it's got custom shop pickups, which are vintage voiced, but just a slightly different. So it's just a modern twist on a vintage spec, and it is a bit weird that there's classic and classic player, but it's just semantics. Well, it's just the way that the series has developed.
Yeah, and of course, because the Classic Player series had the custom shop luthiers involved, so they were essentially trying to make a guitar as good as they could, but affordable, unlike they do in the custom shop, when obviously the gloves are off. It was their aim to make something as good as possible, but within a price point. And that's exactly what the case was with the Rascal bass. That was them trying to make something as unique and interesting and cool as possible within a sort of confined price point. But
that's right. And actually, I feel like it's a bit of a shame, really, that the Rascal came out at a time when it did, because I just think it was ahead of its time is maybe paying it a bit too much.
You are almost right.
I just feel like if the Rascal had come out as part of, say, the Parallel Universe series, where it's...
I mean, even the Offset series, mate. I mean, yeah, think true. How many of the new Offset series Mustang basses you see out and about these days? They're everywhere, because they're such... They're the least amount of money you can spend on something with Fender on the headstock.
True, but the Offset series are all... they're all classic guitars. You know, it's Mustangs, it's Duosonics, it's...
But with modern applications, like it's a PJ pickup
configuration. True, true. And the Mustangs have got... I've got hard tails, and I do appreciate what you're saying, but I think the reason that those guitars are popular is because they are familiar classic shapes at a relatively they don't have the trim, which is a way you save a bit of money, so that's passed on, and they don't have all the weird switching that you get on a Mustang, so you know there's all these little things in there which add up to why things are priced at the place that they are. But I just feel like if the Rascal had been part of a series that was, okay, this is a series of weird guitars, and it will appeal to people who were into weird guitars, you know, it wouldn't look out of place if you had the the Meteora and the Rascal and the Jazz Tele, the Jazz Tele next to each other. That's like, oh, that's a weird series of guitars. I understand. I think the problem is that came out as part of the, as you say, the Classic Player series, which was, okay, well, here's a Strat in a slightly different color. Here's a Telecaster with a four-way switch. And it just kind of was the odd one out.
Yeah, because it was so unique. It was utterly
totally
unique.
Totally, yeah, because it's basic. So for people who don't know, it's a Bass 6 body, and it's got
three lipstick
pickups as well. So, and it's a bass. So really, really weird, really weird loadout on it. But yeah, really cool. Very, very cool. And once again, I think it didn't help that it was in a unique finish in Ocean Turquoise. I think had it come...
And it had that... Had it was a pearl plate as well.
The pearl plate, you know, had that come out in black or in sunburst or in Olympic white or even in butterscotch blonde, you know, anchoring it to the to a fender shape and a fender model, that level of familiarity, I think it would have maybe stood the test of time a little bit more. Yeah. But, you know, these things happen. It is what it is.
I think I agree. Speaking of weird bases and the Parallel Universe series in particular, Fender's latest addition to the Parallel Universe series has finally landed, and it is the their new 51 Telecaster bass, which is odd. It's the only bass that comes in the Parallel Universe series, and it's incredibly close to the 60th anniversary Precision bass that they brought out a few years ago. For all intents and purposes, the only difference I can see is that they've added a jazz bass pickup. So it's a PJ configuration on a 54 style body. So that's the 51 style body, but with the contours and the 51 style plate. Then, you know, with the Telecaster neck. I mean, I wouldn't really call it a tele bass.
Well, but precision-based. That's kind of the point of the Parallel Universe series, isn't
Parallel
it?
Universe,
is it,
yeah, I guess
like,
so.
What would this guitar, in a Parallel Universe, how would this instrument have been released in the time? And I think, again, calling it the Telecaster bass, I think people do kind of call those, those 51... those 51 P basses, I think, do often get referred to as tele basses because they...
And this annoys me because Fender should know better than to keep muddying the waters between the Precision and the tele bass, because of course the tele bass was a thing and it did exist looking exactly like this bass,
yeah,
but with a single coil pickup. Because what Fender initially did is, after they changed the original 51, then 54, 50, the only difference between 51 and the 54 P bass was essentially that they added contours. It was still with the pre-split P bass pickup. After 1957, when they moved to the split coil pickup, they then re-released what was essentially the 54 Precision bass alongside what we now know as the P bass. But because they couldn't call them both the P bass, they renamed it the Tele bass. And then a couple of years later, decided it was too similar, so they redesigned the Telecaster bass again, gave it a more a scratch plate more sort of in line with things like the
Strat,
the 70s Tele, the double humbucker
Tele, oh okay,
the,
yeah,
the custom, and they moved a large, like, mudbucker, sort of in line with what Gibson were putting out on their SG bass at the time, like a mudbucker style huge humbucker, right in the neck position. And they called that the Telecaster bass. And that is the last iteration of the Telecaster bass before it was eventually discontinued, and then we were just left with the P bass. So Fender sort of going back on themselves, releasing the Precision bass and calling it the Telecaster bass is muddying the waters further as to what are the difference between a tele bass and a Precision bass.
Yeah, but...
Especially when this has a jazz bass pickup on it.
Well, yes, but, you know, lots of things have got that PJ loadout nowadays, haven't they? And it's... I think it's just... excuse me. I think it's just a mixture of loads of different guitars, loads of different instruments, because it's got the tele, yeah, kind of aesthetics, but it's got the P bass pickup and it's got the jazz bass pickup. Yeah, it's cool, and I'm glad that there's a P. I'm glad that there's a bass in the Parallel Universe series. I think it's good that people like you aren't left out. It's nice, you know.
Yeah, it's kind of spec wise, it's really good. It's their 60s style or 60s. Single coil jazz bass and Precision bass pickup, which is what they actually put in the recent Mexican reissues of the Mexican 70s Precision and 70s jazz bass, which to my mind, which were also ash bodied, same as this. And to my mind, those 70s P&J that were recently released as FSR were the best sounding affordable Fender basses. I couldn't believe that they were under £1,000. One thing that I'm not entirely sure about this, and I just haven't read enough to have a look, but the controls, don't look concentric. It looks like there are just two. And of course, it's a PJ.
Oh, yeah. That is so interesting. I don't actually know about that.
No, exactly.
I wonder if maybe
which is interesting.
Maybe they're just, maybe it's just, does it say here?
I had a bit of a look beforehand, and I couldn't see anything that suggested what the
I will do some digging, but I wonder if it looks maybe two volumes or something.
Potentially, I think it's dual concentric, and I think it's just not clear from the pictures. And I think
it's
it's got two independent volume and tones for each of the pickups, which is extra. Which is another thing that's dual concentric controls are jazz bass controls. So it's a jazz bass pickup, jazz bass tone controls, and it's called the Tele Bass.
Yeah, well, you know, parallel universe, mate. We do what we want.
That is completely. Completely true. So what else have Fender put out? I guess there is one other thing.
Well, yeah. So the other kind of big thing have we gone through everything else? I think we have. Yeah. So the other big thing that's come out that, you know, has been something that we've been talking about for a little while is the Albert Hammond, the Albert Hammond Jr. Strat, which is a very cool 70s-esque Stratocaster. So
it's a copy of his 1985 reissue of a 1972 Strat.
Right, okay. Yes. Yeah, yeah. So large 70s headstock, three bolt neck plate, and I'm just trying to find it because the thing that's really cool about this guitar is the pickup switching. So this is the main thing, and this is what he has done with his guitar, which is one of the reasons why the guitar's been made. Is the pickup switch position 4 activates the neck and bridge pickup in tandem, unlocking Tele like two pickup tones. Positions 1 and 3 are also reversed from the traditional layout. So what that means is, when it's in position 1, so by the bridge, it's actually in only selecting the middle pickup, because that's what he uses the most. And then when it's in position 2, it's standard position 2, so bridge and middle. And then when it's in position 3, it's only the bridge. And then when it's in position 4, it's neck and bridge. And then when it's in position 5, it's only the neck. So cool, weird little wiring thing.
That is cool.
Yeah, it is. It's
super usable.
Yeah. So it's really, really interesting. Cool guitar, and something for Albert Hammond Jr. fans out there. And you know, less than a grand. So it's a very, very cool guitar.
Yeah, super cool.
So I think that's everything. Can I go now? Fendercast is done. So we'll just talk again next week, right?
Yeah, of course, absolutely. Off you go.
Oh, cool. Thanks, man. Right,
I'll talk through the rest of it. Now, on to some news about some guitars that are actually exciting.
Easy there.
Well, no, actually, let's talk about a company who are ripping off Fender with their latest release. Well, they're not really. I mean, the Telecaster body shape has become pretty universal. But Guitar Center have announced a limited edition version of the Chapman ML3 Pro semi-hollow. Now, the ML3 Pro is, I think, the best Chapman, just because the Tele shape is so good. And Chapman, for me, I really like the guitars and the build quality, but they're very modern. And so, because I like traditional-looking guitars, there's never especially been something in the lineup. Whilst they play amazingly well and feel really good and sound really good, looks-wise, they've never had that thing for me. This looks banging. This is an excellent addition to the range. And it's still modern, but it's got just a few more traditional sensibilities than I've seen previously in their range. I think this is something like the first, or maybe the only the second hollow body guitar that Chapman have done.
Oh right.
I really like their take on the F hole. And I really like the finish. So it's a bound top. It's in a gorgeous sort of black to grey burst, but with a quilted maple top. And then like a maple neck, and you know they always do that the sort of dark wood headstock or matching headstock on the Chapman. So it just looks plush. Now this is a pro, so it is the top end of the Chapman stuff, other than their British built guitars, but it's retailing at $999, which I think is very affordable for sort of the specs of this. You know, you've got like the Hipshot grip lock tuners, a big sort of substantial hardtail bridge, stainless steel frets. The neck is actually baked maple again, in
there
line
we go.
With sort of how everyone's doing these things. And of course, the reason why all these specs are so of the time and attention to detail is because of the way Chapman design their guitars with what they call collaborative sourcing, which is where they essentially ask the opinion of Rob Chapman's 670,000 YouTube subscribers, which is an excellent way.
You said that with a bit of a snarl, Joe. Are you jealous of how many many subscribers he's got?
Absolutely not at all. In any way jealous?
No.
Of that, no, not at all. I think it's an excellent idea. What better way to confirm that you're making the right product for your audience than by asking your audience what products they want in the first place? I think it's a great idea.
Yeah,
but I love the finish. They're calling it Obsidian Burst.
Oh, yeah. Dark. So the thing that I think's cool about this is when was it? It was, where were we? I feel like we were together. Oh no, Mark and I went to, when Mark and I went to the Heavy Music Awards a few months ago, we got the train back with Matt from Chapman Guitars and Rabia and a few other people. And I was just sort of talking with what they've been doing and what's been going on. And it's really cool that Chapman have kind of got themselves established in you know, they've broken America. They've done, even Oasis couldn't break America. Do you know what I mean? Like Chapman have done it. They've broken America. So the fact that they've got this, a US dealer exclusive guitar, I think really shows what you can do when you're I think that Chapman are a really good example for sort of British guitar companies that you can do it. You can break through into the mainstream. I think it's really exciting because it's a small team. You know, obviously Rob has got an army of fans, you know, all over the world, but it really is a small team of people who are making these guitars, who run the company. And I think it's really exciting. I think it's a testament to the work that they've put into it. I think it's very cool.
Absolutely. What a brilliant little company. The reason I'm glad that this guitar's an exclusive, because this is exactly the sort of thing on which they're making their standard line, because I love the company. I think the guitars are really well made. You know, obviously we're mates with everyone in the company, and I'd love there to be a Chapman guitar that was right for me to buy. And at the moment, they always tend to just be that air still slightly on that side of sort of modern metal, just a little bit too much for me.
What you want is a beer baritone in Shell Pink, right? That's essentially what.
Yeah,
this
of
is
course.
A, this is a is this a call to arms for Matt and Rabia to just, you know, get their heads together and get it done?
Yeah, Shell Pink. Yeah, Shell Pink beer baritone. That's what we want
for Joe Branton. The Branton beer baritone.
Oh, I'm into that. I'm going to have to go and trademark that now.
Is that like how when... Because it is funny how we talk about the Les Paul as though it's, you know, the name of a model of a guitar, but actually it's a signature model. You know, it was Les Paul's signature guitar. And so when you think about these people who've got signature guitars, you know, the Billy Joe Armstrong Les Paul is just, that's just two people's names. Do you know what I mean? So it's not inconceivable that one day there could be a Branton Beer baritone, a Chapman Branton Beer.
Yeah, I don't think it's exclusive to guitars. I mean, I think 50 years from now, people will use the word guitar nerds to describe podcasts in general.
Completely. Yeah. And I think it's great that we're actually talking about this, because this is something that we've been talking about privately for a long time, is how, just how...
Did you hear this week's 60 cycle hum guitar nerds? That's what people will say.
Is that what people will say? What, when Ryan and Steve are 90 years old, they're going to be there still... Ryan's going to be like, reruns. I found a reverb that sounds more like a drip than the last one.
Moving on, we should talk about, J-Cross, your favourite category, accessories.
Oh, man, I love accessories.
We happened upon a new accessory, which hasn't actually quite been released yet, but it is available for pre-order.
Yeah, so this shows that actually, I can't believe I'm admitting this, but I was on the Premier Guitar website earlier, and there was an advert. There was an advert on there that I clicked on. I clicked on an advert on Premier Guitar because it enticed me in, and so it shows you that this stuff does actually work. How about that? So this is the this is my favorite area of accessories, which is power supplies. I find this a very exciting thing to talk about.
It's definitely the sexiest thing about accessories.
I think so. I genuinely like talking about this stuff. I think it's very cool. But Eventide have released a new power supply, which is the Power Max. So, as far as I can tell, and we literally found out about this just before we started podcasting, so you will have to apologise if we get this wrong slightly. But the company who make power supplies, and I don't know how you pronounce it. Is it Kiox? Or I always thought Clocks. It was Clocks, but
it is Clocks,
but it's not Clocks because it's an I.
Is it?
It's C-I-O-K-S.
Wait, what if the C and the I are just slightly spaced out versions of the round and upper part of a lowercase d?
So it's Docs. Because
it could be, it's Docs.
You think it's Docs? You think that the name of this company is Docs, despite the fact that their website is clearly C-I-O-K-S.com?
That's what I'm saying.
Yes, okay, fine. Okay, so Eventide appear to have hooked up with Docs and have created the Power Max power supply, which is a very slimline 7-output power supply.
It's an odd number, isn't it?
It is an odd number.
I mean, it is literally an odd number.
Yeah. Yeah, you're right. It's okay. I need to move past this. So it's the thing that's cool about this is all 7 of the outputs can be switched to 9, 12, 15, or 18 volts. And the way that they do this is there are 2 micro switches, 2 dip switches next to each of the outputs. And depending on the way that you have those switches set, that determines the output of the power. So it's honestly, this feels like a puzzle that you would have to solve in Zelda. That's what this feels like to me. So if both dip switches are down, it's 9 volt. If the one on the left is up and the one on the right is down, that's 12 volt. If the one on the left is down and the one on the right is up, that's 15. And if they're both up, that's 18. Oh, and there's a little diagram on the front, so it shows you how they're all supposed to be. Because obviously, this could. I don't think this is really a power supply for beginners, because you could quite easily mess that up and blow up your pedals. So you do have to be careful. But it is laid out right there in front of you. It's really slimline. It works worldwide. They are saying that it will power. With the 7 outputs, you could power 7 H9s, or you could power 7 Strymon pedals. They're all 660 milliamps at 9 volts.
Wow, that's fantastic.
Honestly, it looks great. It looks really, really great.
It looks very Eventide, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does. Yeah, they've got that Eventide branding really nailed down. And it also has a USB output as well, I'm just reading here as well. So
I really like the little traffic light indicator. It has a red, amber, and green light to indicate how much
the load you're using,
the full load.
So this is really, really cool. I was just gonna click and see what the pre-order, what the price is. $199. So actually that's
a lot less than I was expecting it to be. This is a competitor for the MXR ISO bridge.
Oh, totally. Well, yeah, absolutely. And more so than that, you know, the Voodoo Labs power supplies, which are generally...
The Voodoo Labs power supplies, I used to love those, but I have to say that they're falling behind in comparison to everyone else now. They're still really heavyweight. Like, the ones that need that can provide the equivalent power are blooming massive.
Yeah.
And this one, do you know what else is cool about this one? It even comes with an easy mounting kit for pedal train pedal boards.
There we go.
So they've even thought about the sort of boards that they're going to be mounted on, because of course Pedal Train did everyone over a little bit recently when they developed their own power supplies and they changed the structure of the underside of their boards.
Yeah.
Meaning that Voodoo Labs no longer fit. Nor did any of the one spot things. So they do fit. You can get them on there, but it meant that it was no longer an easy solution. So good that Eventide are planning ahead for this.
Yeah, I mean this is even more powerful than the Strymon Zuma. I mean the Strymon Zuma has got 8 outputs each at 500 milliamps, and this has only got the 7. But the 7 they can run at 660. So I think this is great. I think this is really great. I think this is a real competitor for not only, you know, against other power supplies. I think this is a competitor for, like, sort of accessory of the year or other gear of the year for us.
Oh, this is 100% gear of the year.
You think this is going to win gear of the year?
I think it could.
Okay. Anyway.
It's definitely in gear of the year.
I feel like we've talked enough about the Eventide Power Max, which literally I'm the only person who cares about, and you are just being nice and humouring me. I feel like we should move on.
Fair enough. Well, that is actually it. We have come up at time. That is it for us on the regular episode of the podcast, but we will be continuing over on the Patreon episode of the Guitar Nerds podcast, where from as little as a dollar a month, you can support the Guitar Nerds podcast. $1 a month gets you the regular episode ad free and early. $5 a month gets you an extra half an hour every week, and it is a premium half an hour every week. Plus you get a load of bonus features such as mini series. Mark Packham's got his own thing going on there at the moment. Or you can contribute to $10 a month, as we had a new addition from Duncan Watson this week, you become an executive backer, and it grants you access to all of those things, plus the prestigious honour of having your name read out in one breath by me.
We got a new one this week, you said.
And I'm running on 3 hours sleep.
3 hours sleep as well. And probably 3 hours work.
I've been on tour. Oh, less than that. It was Cyber Monday today. I did nothing. Everything sells itself on Cyber Monday.
I suppose so.
Common misconception. You think that the marketing managers have to do work on the sales.
Joe,
that's when the stuff sells itself.
I never think marketing managers do work. So, no, you're incorrect.
Okay, right. Wonderful. Here we go. You ready?
I'm ready, Joe. Are you ready?
I think I don't actually know anymore.
Do you think you're going to be able to do this?
You know what? I'm not sure, because I'm very unfit at the moment. I've put on a little bit of tour weight from excessive booze and fried foods.
People
and,
booing you whilst polymath are playing. Is that what it is?
Exactly what it is. Yeah, exactly. But I'm unfit and exhausted, and you know, it's not good for my lung capacity.
Okay. Well, I believe in you. Right.
Thank you. Thank you.
Duncan Watson, Adrian Day, Ethan Jebediah Partier, Ken Sayre, Matthew King, Stephen Conrady, Gordon G. Richard III, Marin Peters, Sean Arbo, Christopher Wolfett, Chumpetson, Robert Cousins, Rob Drew, Scott Hamilton, Tucker Amadon, Ernie Cooper, Nate Nagel, Ross Edwards, Christoph Remsen, Robbie Cotter-Clark, Matt Roberts, Dave Lee, Emery James Baker, Ryan McDermott, Juan Correa, Blake Wyland, Aaron Simon, Jake Gray, Matt Bellamy, Martin Cliff, Scott Kennedy, Crystal Lawson, Robin Smith, Hans Hans, Derek Ritz, Chris Connors, Andy Joyce, Rod Nordic, Steve Larkin, Mark Cross, Carlos Mantra, Andy McKenzie, Brad Page, Blair Thomas, Laurie Ansis, Paul Corrigan, Will Clare, Moog, Robert Riddle, Thompson, Colin Anderson. I can still keep going. I guess I've got something back. Maybe touring all this time is actually a good idea, and now I've got my breath back.
I made it.
I feel like your recovery time's been all right as well. Yeah, maybe being on tour is your natural habitat. Maybe working in an office is bad for you.
I think you're probably right. I should quit and just do this all the time. Oh, dear. Yes, anyway, thank you. There you have it. You can follow us on Twitter and Instagram at Guitar Nerds, or on YouTube at Guitar Nerds Videos. You can even visit our website, guitarnerds.net, where all our various channels are displayed in all of their glory.
Don't do that. It's nothing.
Yeah, don't
on
do
there.
That. Don't do that. No, there's nothing there. And you can even purchase a Guitar Nerds merchandise to become a true
blah, blah,
member
blah,
of
blah,
the
blah,
club.
Blah, blah, blah. What are we talking about on Patreon, blah, Joe? We haven't talked about it.
Oh yes. What are we talking about on the Patreon? I can't remember. You decided.
We're talking about a question that we got sent that was really good, and we were going to try and do. We had thought about doing in the main podcast, but then realized that, you know, Fendercast was going to take over our time. So we have got a question from Tam Miller, which sounds like someone who is trying to be mean to us, but what they've said here is, with so many boutique brands about, why would anyone buy a mainstream brand guitar for a grand or more? And I think we've both got quite a lot of opinions on that, so that's what we're doing. Yes. Talking about in the Patreon.
Yes, we certainly will. We will talk about that next week. We will be back, and Mark Packham will be joining us in actuality next week. So it'll be me, Jay, and Mark Packham, which will be fun. But that is it from us for this week. We'll catch you next time for some more guitar nerdery. Farewell.
Beautiful. Cheers, gang.